You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a collection of recordings from Twilight Zone creator Rod Serling has been digitized and preserved as part of a UW-Madison project. We'll learn about that project and Serling's legacy. First, between now and November's Election Day, Wisconsin Public Radio has invited candidates who are running in contested races for statewide office and congressional seats to join us for interviews on Central Time and on The Morning Show. You can find all of those interviews at wisconsinvote.org. Today we talked to Representative Gwen Moore. She's the Democratic incumbent running for re-election to represent Wisconsin's 4th Congressional District seat, which includes Milwaukee. Representative Moore, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, what do you see as the top priority facing your constituents in particular in the 4th District?
I think the top priority for my constituents in the 4th District is to make sure that there is a decent, affordable health care and that we protect the Great Lakes and that we protect entitlements. The story, the lead-in to this program, Rob, I was listening, and we heard Mitch McConnell talk about the $700 billion deficit that occurred after we did this huge tax cut for the wealthiest corporations and for the wealthiest individuals, and he just blamed it on entitlements and said that we've really got to do something with Social Security, Medicare, and so I think that, quote-unquote entitlement reform, protecting that resource not only for this generation but going forward is also an issue for my constituents.
Yeah, let's
health care, entitlements, and protecting our Great Lakes.
Let's jump into that deficit issue you mentioned. What would you do, supposing you're in a majority Democratic House come next year, what would you do when it comes to spending and that deficit?
Well, I'll tell you, I am certainly I'm so excited about getting reelected, and the prospect of being in the majority is really, really thrilling to me. It would be the first time that I'd have an opportunity to really make a serious bid for being on the Ways and Means Committee. And, of course, that's the committee that determines tax policy, Medicare funding, Social Security funding, welfare reform. And those really are at the seat of where the money is and where the fights and struggles over how we're going to go forward and to protect ordinary Americans will occur. For one thing, we have a $1.4 trillion tax cut. And, of course, we're not going to walk in day one and say, oh, let's just repeal that. But there are serious flaws with how it was put together. It certainly favors certain industries like the real estate industry that Donald Trump and his family are engaged in at the expense of everyone else. It certainly, we've already seen, creates great deficits. And inequality is a real core rot at having a democracy and an economy that works for everybody.
You also mentioned health care. There's been some back and forth within your party, the Democratic Party, about the Affordable Care Act versus some kind of a Medicare for All program. What would you look for?
Well, I tell you that our opportunities for saving health care is really going to have an impact on everyone, because even those people who receive health care in the private sector are going to see their premiums grow exponentially. And there are people out there who get their health care through their employers who are now complaining of paying $300, $400, $500 a month for their health care as well. And those premiums are only going to rise. Health care, we're going to have to see it as some kind of utility at some point, where we make sure that we don't create gross health inequalities just based on whether or not people are employed or whether or not people have money. We're going to have to look at how to expand the base of people who are paying for health care. I think the repeal of the individual mandate, has been a great mistake, because healthcare is the kind of commodity that everyone uses at some point or another. And whether they are insured or pay for it or not, the rest of us do pay for it. So we have got to come up with a health something that resembles health care for all, that is affordable for everyone.
Talking to Representative Gwen Moore, Democratic incumbent running for re-election in Wisconsin's 4th Congressional District. Representative Moore, let's talk about immigration a little bit. This has been an issue that keeps coming up for you in the House again and again. What do you want to see come out of this issue in 2019?
Well, I just think it's absolutely nuts that we don't have some sort of comprehensive immigration reform. You know, there are, when we start talking about deficits again, there are all kind of data and studies from our own congressional research services that indicate that we could decrease the deficit by over $1 trillion over the course of a decade just by taking some of these immigrants out of the shadows. You know, many immigrants, especially some who are from Mexico, have a lot of skills in trades, and that would be a great commercial. And in farming, it would be a great addition to our fledgling Social Security fund, for example, to have them paying into to that fund. And we could reduce the deficit. I think that the Dreamers, it's absolutely outrageous that we are holding them hostage when, for all intents and purposes, you know, they're American citizens. They've been here since they were 2 years old, 5 years old. It is and really dangling them around and holding them hostage to partisan politics is shameful. And this is a country of immigrants. You know, as the old adage goes, we may have all come over on different ships, but we're all in the same boat now as Americans.
One possible outcome, there's a lot of different ways things could go, but you could be in a Congress where there's a Democratic House, still a Republican Senate, and, of course, a Republican president. Do you see nightmare gridlock and nothing gets done, or do you see a chance to come to agreements with Republicans where you have to concede some to them, they have to concede to you?
Well, I've been elected to legislative bodies for quite a while, and honestly, I'm a long way away from the days where I thought, boy, I'm just going to go in there and just make 50 laws a day. Sometimes having a check and stopping bad things from happening is a really, really good stewardship. I think the fact that all three branches of government were controlled by Republicans, the U.S. Senate, the House, and the presidency, we saw a tax bill get written literally overnight and passed. And deficits, as far as the eye can see, being expected to come. We have seen a Supreme Court justice sort of just ram through with the president saying, you know, well, it doesn't matter that we have laughed and made fun of an alleged victim. We won. These are the kinds of things that don't happen when you have a check and balance in place. I think there are a lot of things that can really get done with split government. I think Americans have had that before, and it works out well because, you know, everybody wants to get something done, and with split government, you have to talk to each other. And so should that be the case, I'd be happy to be the body that's in the majority in the House to be able to be a check and balance, as well as to offer some really good bipartisan ideas like fixing our infrastructure. We've got a big lead infrastructure problem here in the state of Wisconsin. I want to make sure our Great Lakes Initiative and keeping our water clean here in the Great Lakes can be something that's bipartisan, and to make sure that that healthcare, that we do something to make sure that people with pre-existing conditions, which is everybody I know, quite.
And we'll have to leave it there. We're out of time. Thanks to Representative Gwen Moore, Democrat representing Wisconsin's 4th Congressional District, running for re-election. You can follow all of our Ideas Network candidate interviews at wisconsinvote.org. It's the theme from Twilight Zone, which premiered in 1959. It's being revived by Get Out director Jordan Peele. The show was originally created and narrated by prolific screenwriter Rod Serling. The Twilight Zone was just one of many shows or films that Serling helped create, including The Night Gallery and Planet of the Apes. And the University of Wisconsin-Madison is home to a large collection of Serling's audio recordings as he dictated scripts on a now-defunct technology. The school recently received a grant to preserve and digitize these recordings for future use. Our next guests are here to talk about the project and the legacy of Rod Serling. Mary Hilsbeck is the Assistant Director of the Wisconsin Center for Film and Theater Research at the UW-Madison, and Lily Holman is a graduate student at UW-Madison involved with the project. Mary, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
And Lily, thanks for joining us.
Of course, thank you.
Well, Mary, let's start. This is kind of a random thing in some ways to end up at UW-Madison. Why is this collection of Rod Serling dictation ending up here?
Yeah, so back in the 1960s, we would write everybody and anybody in film, television, and theater and propose that they establish a collection at the Wisconsin Center for Film and Theater Research. And Serling was one of those people, and he started donating material in 1963. He donated several times throughout the 60s, and these dictabelts came in two of his donations.
And talk about what a dictabelt is, because a lot of people will never have encountered this.
Yeah. So they're plastic belts. The dictaphone machine was invented in 1947. So through the 40s, 50s, 60s, into the 70s, screenwriters, doctors, businessmen would use the dictaphone machine to record correspondence, notes, scripts. And it's a plastic belt. It's a piece of plastic. I think it's about 6 inches wide, and it can contain, you know, up to 15, 16 minutes of material. And they'd put it on the machine and talk into the microphone, and it would impress a groove onto the plastic.
And Lily, can you talk about the significance of having Rod Serling's voice talking about what he wanted to film, whether it was on his TV show or books or whatever?
Of course. So one of the really cool things is how unrehearsed the dictabelts are. So we're very used to hearing Serling's voice as this very polished, kind of all-powerful narration in whether it be the Twilight Zone or Night Gallery. So when you first tune into these dictabelts and it's kind of uncertain and rough, it's just you have this kind of immediate counter to what you're used to. And so it tells you a lot more about the person.
And what kind of stuff do we hear Rod Serling saying on these?
Oh, it's a broad variety. Mostly it's scripts, and it's very, very technical. So he's vocalizing all the stage directions, all the punctuation. But you also hear many of his correspondence, or I've even heard him kind of dictate to-do lists to his assistant Marjorie. It's a broad variety, but it's mostly scripts.
Well, let's give a listen now to the voice of Rod Serling on one of these dictabelt recordings.
A high angle looking down on Miss Menlo in bed. Dash. A large, vapid-eyed piece of white alabaster. Blending with the whiteness of the room. Not white alabaster, just alabaster. Blending with the whiteness of the room. A nurse enters, moves over to the bed, checks her pulse, studies the grim little profile. Miss Menlo says, "What is it this time?" Question mark. A pill, a syringe, a pill, question mark, a syringe, syringe, question mark. Or just more of the tribal tiptoeing. Tribal right, T-R-I-B-A-L, right, R-I-T-E, tiptoeing, in and out that goes on around here, question mark.
All right, if you'd come to me and said, hey, we've got this Rod Serling spoken word poetry, I would have believed you listening to that. There's a Rod Serling style here, right?
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, he started dictating his scripts early in his television career, and that was his preferred way of working, so he didn't sit at a typewriter and type it out and then make changes. It's just coming straight from his mind onto the dictabelt.
What's it like to listen to these recordings? I mean, were you a Twilight Zone watcher before this?
Yes.
Or Night Gallery? Or
Twilight Zone, okay. Mostly. I've started examining Night Gallery as well, which has been a fun discovery. But it's just the first one I heard, he addresses his assistant directly in the first 6 seconds. And you're just suddenly in the space of hearing him talk to you, and it is like he is talking to you, and you do get totally immersed in the storytelling. And so it means that the corrections and the punctuation are very jarring when you finally hear them, and you do kind of take a step back and try to figure out exactly what he's doing. And your first reaction is surely he's reading off of something, because it's stuff like the question marks and the quotes. It surely that's not all in his memory. But then you find out that it is, and then you hear him kind of hem and haw about, like, what quality of alabaster he wants to go for. And so it's this, again, this kind of wonderful mix where you kind of hear his genius, and that he can just kind of go on these long monologues about human nature and then also not remember what he named someone in a previous dictabelt.
Talking to Mary Hilsbeck and Lily Holman from UW-Madison, looking at these Rod Serling dictabelt recordings in this effort to keep them, preserve them for the future. And Mary, let's talk about that. This is a kind of technology that isn't going to last forever.
Right. That's part of the reason. We wrote a grant, and we're lucky enough to get a grant from the Council on Library and Information Resources. They got money from the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation to hand out these grants. The dictabelts are plastic, and like any plastic, they deteriorate, and they've started to deteriorate enough to make us worry about them. But also, the machines aren't being made anymore, so it's a challenge to find people who can digitize them.
So right now, if I was a film and TV researcher, and I was like, wow, I can hear Rod Serling's creative process at work, I'd have to come here, right, and listen and hope you have a working dictabelt machine. Is that right?
Well, not anymore.
Yeah, no.
Well, that's, I mean, up till now, right?
Yeah,
right.
Sorry.
These weren't accessible to anyone because we don't have a working dictabelt machine, and you also need to be really careful when you're digitizing any legacy material, whether it's audio or video or film, that you have the proper equipment and the proper expertise to do that, and we just didn't have that. Mm-hmm. So we worked with a company called Scene Savers, and they've done a fabulous job for us.
So they are all digitized now, is that right, or are we on the way?
Yeah, all of the Serling dictabelts have been digitized, as well as we have dictabelts in Dalton Trumbo's collection, as well as another screenwriter, Adrian Spies, and the producer, Walter Wanger.
Wow. And so how now, if I'm that film and TV researcher, Lily, can I do? How can I access these?
Go to the Wisconsin Center for Film and Theater Research and talk to Mary. The Dalton Trumbo, at the very least, you can just request ahead of time, mm-hmm. and you can go and listen to them on a boombox there. The Serling ones are still in that process of coming out more publicly, so you'd get in contact with Mary.
Yeah.
And Mary, can you talk about the value of artifacts like this for American culture?
Yeah, I mean, this is such a unique recording format, and people didn't often save these. You know, it's remarkable that Serling and Marjorie Lansford, his assistant, saved them and thought to send them to us. Usually these just got tossed after they had been transcribed. So we would be missing out on hearing the voice and hearing the process.
Yeah, Lily, can you talk about that? Because there are probably a lot of artists out there, I mean, going back centuries, where you'd love to be able to hear their inner voice at work. Mm-hmm. We can see the final product, and in many cases, that's it. What is it like being able to watch it develop in stages?
Well, one thing, and it's not to discredit Serling's own work or Trumbo's, but one thing that's really interesting is the insight you get into the process and the multiple people involved in the process. Because one thing, the kind of unsung hero for me of studying the dictabelts is Marjorie Lansford, or in the case of Trumbo, he had a variety of assistants, mostly his family, transcribing these for them. But you can also hear, based off of the way that Serling and Trumbo speak to them, and also the tasks that are being granted to them, how heavily involved these assistants and secretaries and stenographers were in the creative process. And so that was a really, I think it's really hard to deny their influence when you hear them getting directly addressed, you're hearing the tasks that are given to them, and you remember that we would not have these records or these scripts even without their contribution. So that's been my favorite and most fruitful insight, I think.
Yeah, and I've done some transcribing of audio. It is grueling work,
for, yes.
especially when somebody's speaking in, you know, at the speed of their thoughts, not slowing down for you.
Yeah.
So what is next? How are you hoping these ultimately get used, Mary?
Well, we're hoping that scholars, both television and film scholars, will come to Madison to listen to them, to not only gain new insight into Serling's career, but the screenwriting process, you know, how film and television developed, especially in the late 1960s. I think there's just a myriad of ways that people could use these.
And before we wrap up, Lily, have you gone back and watched episodes you've heard being detailed and watched them a little differently?
Yes. Well, the original ones I listened to were in kind of bits and pieces uh-huh. are harder to find. But the Night Gallery, he has extensive dictabelts on. And so I have been trying to compare and contrast a bit of the Night Gallery episode Eyes, which we have the dictabelts for. And that's been really cool to kind of see what drastic changes there are and what carries over and things like that.
Well, thanks to both of you for coming up to the studio.
Thank you.
Mary Hillsback is the Assistant Director of the Wisconsin Center for Film and Theater Research at the UW-Madison, and Lily Holman is a graduate student at UW-Madison. They both join us to talk about a project aimed at digitizing and preserving audio recordings from The Twilight Zone and the Night Gallery creator, Rod Serling. Now more than 300,000 people in the United States with temporary protected status are in legal limbo as the program comes to an end in the midst of a challenge in the court system. The program has allowed people, sometimes for decades, to live in the United States because their home countries are too dangerous to stay in. The countries directly involved are El Salvador, Haiti, Honduras, Nicaragua, Nepal, and Sudan. Our next guest is here to talk about the Temporary Protected Status Program and other issues surrounding immigration in the Trump administration. Alan Gomez is a Miami-based immigration reporter at USA Today. Alan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, tell us about the TPS, the Temporary Protected Status Program. What is it? How does it work?
It was created in 1990 by Congress, and what it does is it allows people whose home countries have been devastated by natural disasters or some sort of armed conflict to remain in the U.S. for a temporary amount of time while their countries recover. So picture earthquakes, hurricanes, civil wars, things like that. But what ended up happening is that administration after administration, both Republican and Democrat, started extending the program for very long periods of time. It's only supposed to be about 12 to 18 months, but administrations are allowed to extend it. So in the case of El Salvador, the largest group, which has about 195,000 people in the TPS program, they were first granted TPS in 1991 based on an earthquake, but multiple administrations allowed Salvadorans to continue staying in the U.S. under TPS because of the different deteriorating conditions in El Salvador, most notably the raging crime that's raging down there. And what the Trump administration did when they came in is said, well, look, the original conditions of TPS for El Salvador, that earthquake, those conditions have subsided. And so all 195,000 should have to go back. And that's what forms the basis for the legal fight that we're seeing now.
And some of these TPS statuses, as you mentioned, have been in place for upwards of 20 years. Is there a case to be made that this wasn't originally what Congress intended when they passed this?
Absolutely. I mean, there's people who support the president have been repeating a refrain quite often saying T is for temporary. It's in the title. It's right there. And that was definitely the original intent of this program. But the other argument is that, yes, it's been sort of extended for too long. It's been abused for a little bit too long. But at this point, how do you tell a family who's been here for 20 years, who's been working, who's raised a family? Reminder, these are people that have to be re-vetted every 18 months or so. So we know they have clean criminal records. We know that they're working. And so the argument is, okay, look, change the program moving forward, But how can you tell these people who've been here for decades to go back to these countries, especially when you consider that of all, there's about 300,000 who are in the program, they've had about 270,000 children while they've been in the U.S., all U.S. citizens. So that decision that they're facing now is, do we stay in the country and risk becoming an undocumented immigrant? Do we go home as the parents and leave our children behind in the U.S., or do we go back to our home country and then take our child back to a country that they've never known, they may never speak, they may not even speak the language, and is possibly a pretty serious security risk in the case of most of these countries.
As part of your reporting, you talked to a family here from Haiti. What did you learn?
I mean, it was just really interesting talking to a lot of these families who are going through this because, you know, when you talk to them, it's just you see the basic American experience. This is the man's name is Ronnie Pontil. He's a registered nurse at an emergency hospital down here in Miami, and his daughter is 11 years old, born here. She speaks three languages and is quite an accomplished piano player, and she is just beside herself, just you know, very articulate, a young lady, and trying to explain the situation that they're in. And she says, she talks about having to go back to Haiti, where she's never been. She doesn't speak Creole. She has no idea what she would do there. Or does she stay here when her parents go back, and then she's forced to either live with another family, or she put it, be thrown into the system and have a foster family or something like that, and the worries that that brings with it. So, yeah, it's just really interesting to see it firsthand and to understand, to hear the debates that they're having. And I can tell you that this one family is an embodiment of what's going on in thousands of households around the country, as they remain in this legal limbo and they face that very real prospect of having to be ordered back home, possibly soon, depending on how quickly the legal cases are resolved.
Talking to Alan Gomez, immigration reporter at USA Today, about immigration issues, including the temporary protected status program, maybe coming to an end for many people protected under that program. Alan, you mentioned legal limbo. A lot of what the Trump administration has changed on immigration has gone to the courts. Where does this temporary protected status program stand in terms of legal challenges and actually being implemented?
Yeah, so this is just one of the many attempts by the Trump administration to limit both legal and illegal immigration that has, let's say, run into some hiccups in the courts. A federal judge just a couple of weeks ago out in California ruled that the administration used a flawed legal reasoning and a flawed process to end the program. And in that ruling, Judge Edward Chen made clear that he felt, and there was enough evidence to show, that the administration may have used, quote, an animus against non-white, non-European immigrants to reach its conclusion and to reach its decision to end this program. So he stopped it. So basically, right now, TPS remains active. These people can stay here. They can stay here legally to live and to work. And now we start the process. Now it goes to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and then it could go from there to the Supreme Court. And it's important to note on that, since the judge made reference to Trump's previous comments when it comes to, you know, the president used a very choice word when talking about Haiti at one point, and he's made many comments about immigrants coming from Central America. The judge based his ruling in part on those arguments, but it's important to know that the Supreme Court has ruled on something similar. If you remember the travel ban from last year, the courts stopped the administration from implementing that travel ban based on his racial animus or perceived at the time. But the Supreme Court, just this past June, finally gave approval to the travel ban and disregarded those comments. That was a 5-4 majority when Justice Kennedy was still on the court. But every indication is that Justice Kavanaugh would kind of lean in that same direction. So the administration may end up being vindicated here when it reaches the Supreme Court. It's just a question of how quickly it gets there and how Kavanaugh will rule on that one.
One question with this temporary protected status is, okay, even if the initial disaster, say earthquake, that is in the past and been recovered from, is this a safe place to go back? And you did a survey kind of the six countries in question here. Talk about the conditions in those countries and what people would be going back to.
Yeah, and that's one of the central things about this debate right here. Do you base your decision to extend a country's TPS status on that original reason that it was granted TPS? So let's use Haiti again for an example. The reason they were placed or granted TPS status was the that 2010 earthquake that just decimated Haiti. The administration has previous administrations have ruled that, hey, maybe the effects of that earthquake, they're past that, but ever since, Haiti has been hit with a massive cholera outbreak. It's been hit by two hurricanes and continues just experiencing tragedy after tragedy. So the Obama administration, because of all that, said, look, things are still terrible right now. This country is not prepared to absorb 46,000 Haitians that are living in the United States under TPS status. What the Trump administration is saying is, hey, they're past that earthquake. We're sorry, but it's time for you to go back. This was a temporary program. And we found similar situations in all of the countries. Nepal, for example, just had its earthquake 3 years ago, and reconstruction there is, by the best estimates by the Nepalese government, is at about 40% to 50% back. They're back online from that earthquake. Yet the Trump administration said, no, it's good enough. We can send them back. El Salvador, Honduras, these are places that rank in the top 10 of murder rates around the world right now. So while the violence there was not what got them their TPS designation to begin with, again, previous administrations had argued, okay, well, sending tens, and in the case of El Salvador, 200,000 people back there is not the wisest thing to do and would be putting these people in harm's way. So each of these countries still face major challenges, and the question is whether they can absorb these massive numbers of people going back to their countries.
We're talking to Alan Gomez, immigration reporter at USA Today. We're talking about the temporary protected status program, which would end under Trump administration plans for around 300,000 people from six different countries, and about the Trump administration policies on immigration in general. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the temporary protected status program? What do you think about the idea of ending these protections for people from these six different countries? How would you characterize overall the Trump administration approach to immigration and refugees as well? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation about the likely end of the temporary protected status program for people from six countries around the world and other issues facing immigration in the United States. Alan Gomez is with us, immigration reporter for USA Today. He's based in Miami. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about this program, how it works, who it has applied to? What are your thoughts on immigration policy under the Trump administration? Do you have questions about some of the latest news? There's a lot going on, some of it crowded out of the news by other stories. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Andy is on the line in Libertyville, Illinois. Andy, hello.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Andy?
So I just had a question. I'm trying to understand why, you know, what the rationale from the conservative or the GOP is on why they would not take, you know, these people and keep them in the United States as they've been productive members of society. What if you kind of cut through all the, you know, politics of it? What is the real reason why the GOP doesn't want them here? I don't understand that. I'm hoping your guest speaker can speak to that.
Andy, thanks for the call. And Alan, this has been a debate within the Republican Party as well. Can you sort some of that out?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to really get in their minds and hearts when they do something like this. But what we've seen from this administration is a top-to-bottom, across-the-board effort to limit, again, both legal and illegal immigration in every way that they can. The president campaigned very strenuously on the question of illegal immigration, but what we've seen in practice is their attempts to do everything that they can to limit legal immigration. So we've seen, we saw in his first full year, a drop in the number of green cards issued by the administration, a drop in the number of visas issued for people to come for short-term stays, a historic drop in the number of refugees accepted by the U.S., attempts to limit the asylum application process for people coming here fleeing violence in different places. And so this would easily fall into that category where it's clear that they've done a complete look at our immigration system and tried to identify ways to limit legal immigration. And this, in some sense, was an easy one because it was a temporary program. That's how it was designed. And so every time they've announced that they're ending TPS for each country, they very rightfully say this was a temporary program. The conditions were met. We're following the letter of the law. Simple as that. But when you put it in that broader context of everything else they're doing, it does fit into that broader idea of just using any means possible to limit legal immigration into the U.S.
Andy, thanks for that call. Alan, there's been a stream of thought in the Republican Party, kind of a chamber of commerce mindset, I guess, that's been more okay with immigration in part to provide workers to companies around the country. Is this still an active debate within the Republican Party?
Well, that depends on how you define the Republican Party of today. As we see, Trump, if we talk about Trump's version of the Republican Party, it's a very clear-cut, sort of nationalistic, close the borders, let's try to keep everyone out as much as we can. But for decades, there has been that broader argument from conservatives, from the Chamber of Commerce, from business owners, who argue that we just don't have a functioning immigration system that gets enough qualified and enough good workers into the U.S. So, I think the number that came out in the last couple of days was this idea that there's 7 million job openings in the United States. That's more than the number of unemployed Americans in the United States. So that would seem to be a pretty clear indication that we need more workers. But the work visas that we offer right now are incredibly limited, both on the high-tech end and all the way down to the agricultural sector. So their business owners routinely complain about the fact that they cannot find enough workers to fill their ranks. That's the traditional side of the Republican Party.
Talking to Alan Gomez from USA Today about immigration policy under the Trump administration. Alan, I want to turn to a couple different issues that you've been tracking. First, family separation, unattended minors. This was huge news for a while. It's back out of the mainstream media eye, it seems like. But what is going on now?
Well, as luck would have it, they just finished up a court hearing in San Diego to get an update on that. And so I can tell you that there has been there's about 2,600 families that were separated over the summer. This was through the president's zero tolerance policy. We're up to about 2,300 of those kids who have been either reunited with their parents or have been placed with other approved sponsors. There's still about 245 of these kids, though, who are still in government custody. And so there's quite a bit of back and forth with the lawyers from the ACLU and the Department of Justice over the best way and the quickest way to finalize those remaining cases. Here we are 4 months after a judge ordered all those families to be removed, and we still have 245 kids who are in government custody. So obviously that process is moving along. Not as quickly as most people had hoped for. And then separately, we heard from the President Trump himself this weekend that the administration is considering a new strategy to separate families in another way. Just to try to sum this up as quickly as I can for your listeners, the zero tolerance policy over the summer created an immediate separation of families where the parents were charged criminally for crossing the border, and they were sent to adult immigration detention. The kids were sent over to the Department of Health and Human Services to be housed over there. What the administration is contemplating now is giving immigrants an option. So if they come over as a family unit, what they would do is say, okay, you can either stay together indefinitely for months, possibly years, as your asylum applications or your deportation hearings proceed, or you can allow your child to be placed with Health and Human Services. We can put them with a sponsor, and you stay in detention as the parent to try to fight your own case. So this would be sort of a giving them, you know, giving immigrants the option of being separated from their child. And so, yeah, this is clearly something that's ongoing. The administration feels very strongly that as long as families can come here together and will eventually be released from custody, that that will continue being a lure for these families to come over here. Obviously, immigration advocates say that any separation of families and any future plans to continue doing so is a violation of human rights, international law, and all sorts of U.S. law and court hearings, rulings.
Another story, the president pointing toward a group of people coming from Honduras. I think it is hundreds of people. They're in Guatemala now. He's referring to it as a caravan, threatening to cut off aid to Honduras if they can't stop this particular group or stop groups seeking to come up and cross the U.S. border. What's the latest on that?
Yeah, I mean, this is basically just a repeat in case, you know, your readers, your viewers, your listeners remember this at all from last year. The same thing happened last year. It's an annual thing where basically many immigrants who are trying to reach the U.S. border, they band together not to stream across in a horde, but they do that for security reasons. Crossing Central America and crossing Mexico by yourself or in a small group can be an incredibly dangerous process. And so they do this as an attempt to get there safely and get there together. And it's important to know, and this is something that's often lost when you hear the president talk about this, is that the majority of them are coming over here and announcing that they're trying to seek asylum. And U.S. law allows for people to present themselves at a port of entry and request asylum. That is something that they are legally allowed to do. The president paints it as they're trying to cross the border illegally, but it wouldn't make a lot of sense for a group to come over in such a large group, be posting on Facebook, announcing where they are, if their intent was to sneak across the border and enter illegally. So they're on their way. The president has threatened to cut off any sort of foreign aid that's going to Honduras if they can't stop this. It's out of the Honduran hands already. They're now in Guatemala. The next step would be Mexico. So it's a long way, and a lot of them will probably drop off along the way, but that's where we are right now.
And briefly, Alan, Congress could sort a lot of these issues out. I'm going to guess we're not going to see anything, at least between now and the new Congress coming in January.
Yeah, I mean, I think I saw something where Senator Cornyn, number two Republican in the Senate, there's talk that he's going to meet with some immigration groups just a couple of days after the November election to talk about things like deferred action for childhood arrivals. That's another 800,000 or so immigrants who may lose their legal status, and to talk about some of those other things. But I can tell you, I don't think it really matters whether Democrats take over either House of Congress in November. The track record on immigration in Congress has been abysmal. For years, they've been unable to agree on even the most minor changes or updates to our immigration laws. So looking for any resolution or looking for any solution out of Washington, out of Congress specifically, is a really difficult thing to do right now.
We'll leave it there for now. Thanks to Alan Gomez from USA Today. Join us for a look at a number of immigration issues going on in the United States.